In the first quarter of this year, the song Tugboat by indie rock band Galaxy 500 was played on the internet radio station or streaming service Pandora 7,800 times. For this, the songwriters received a check for 21 cents. Musicians have always had to deal with a middleman of sorts, record labels, promoters taking a big cut of their earnings, if there were any earnings. But with digital technology and music sharing online, the old middlemen have been pushed aside. New middlemen have emerged and the rules have changed. Who is making any money on music these days and how? During this hour, we'll talk with musicians and music writers about the impact of digital technology on the industry and try to figure out where things are headed. Joining us are Damon Krukowski and Steve Knopper. Damon Krukowski is half of the indie rock duo Damon and Naomi and was also in Galaxy 500. He has recently written an article about this topic for Pitchfork titled Making Sense, as in pennies. And Steve Knopper is a contributor to Rolling Stones and has written Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. Steve, hello to you.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hello, and hello, Damon.
Hello, thank you for having me, Micah.
Thank you so much. Now, Damon, I want to start with you. You got into music in the 80s. What did it take back then, all those years ago? What did it take to be successful?
Well, I can't speak to success because we never really had it. But I can speak to what it took to start, which was really nothing. But, I mean, that's still true. Maybe in some ways more so, given online distribution of music, which is really a tremendously powerful tool for musicians at every level. But in what I wrote the article about was what it was like to try and learn the business about being in a band and making records when we started and what it's like now, and that's what's changed tremendously.
So back then you made physical records and you sold them to your fans. What was the cut you took back then?
Well, it's pretty much the same as now, which is that you manufacture records and you price them for more than you pay to make them. It's as simple as that. It's like running a lemonade stand. And it really took no more economic know-how or business sense, and certainly none of us had any more than that, I don't think, to turn a profit on a record. All you really needed was an audience that wanted your music enough to take a chance on the cost of buying a 7-inch single or eventually an LP or an EP, and that just wasn't much. And it's very easy, really, to manufacture records and sell them at a profit because they don't cost that much to make, and people are used to paying a price for them that is easily, usually double what they cost even in for a short run of a band. Of course, retail prices are much higher. Profit margins when you manufacture in greater quantities.
Now, Damon, one more question before we turn to Steve. You say you weren't successful, but of course that is not true. People know your music, still know and love your music. How did you get the word out back then? What did it take?
Right, well, I meant that we weren't successful
financially. Yes,
financially, right. Right, which is true, and that's important to remember, that it's not like I'm speaking from the position of someone who did make a lot of money in the music industry and now thinks it's so hard. It wasn't that at all. We never made a lot of money. But we got our music out, and in that regard, yes, I consider it very successful.
And did you have a label? Who helped you get the word out about your music?
Oh, well, you know, it was the classic just word of mouth to start with, and then eventually you draw the attention of a label, which helps you get the word to a larger circle that isn't within your immediate reach. But we started very simply playing for the local scene in Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts, excuse me, and some people were interested in our music. It wasn't like we were a sensation by any means. And we made a demo tape that we gave to local radio, to college radio, nonprofit radio, community radio, and then we pressed a single, which is two songs, A-side, B-side, and the same thing, we gave it to college radio, and then we started to try some of the more commercial stations in town, and only the ones that were interested in so-called college rock at the time would even consider it. And then ultimately we were signed to a label, but not here in the U.S., we actually were signed to a label in England, Rough Trade, and they released our records, and we had a much greater audience wherever they had the greatest reach, which was in Europe and in England.
And this, the same still seems to be true for many bands who do better in Europe than over here. Steve Knopper, let me turn to you. Back in those days, if bands were financially successful, if they were selling their CDs, how was the money split? If I paid $18 for a CD in the store, how was that money chopped up?
Yeah, it sort of depended. I mean, it depended on what type of contract you had with a record label. And as Damon mentioned, you know, there were independent record labels, and there were labels that went bankrupt, and there were the biggest of the major labels, such as Sony or Warner. And every band got a different percentage, and some of that was and is dependent on sort of how much leverage a band has. So, you know, Metallica, although they don't have a label anymore, I understand, but, you know, in their heyday when they were with Warner, they were able to negotiate a very high royalty rate. Whereas, you know, sadly, a band like Galaxy 500, which is one of my favorite bands, a great band, actually the first band that I ever did a phone interview with as a music writer back in 1991. So
really? Were we polite?
Well, it was actually with Dean. I'm sorry to say. It wasn't with you, Damon.
He wasn't, this is what you're saying.
No. He was actually quite charming and was kind, because I had no idea how to do any of this at that point.
That's good.
So the smaller bands were getting a smaller cut.
Bands were getting a smaller cut because they didn't have any leverage. You know, whether they were with an indie label or whether they were a small band that was with a big label, they were often in sort of the forgotten position.
And some of the labels were making major money.
Yes, of course. I mean, in the heyday of the CD, which is, you know, I call it the CD boom, which lasted, you know, roughly from the early 80s to about the year 2000 when Napster came along. You know, it wouldn't be completely uncommon for a band to make anywhere from, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5. Michael Jackson maybe made $7 or $8 off of each individual CD sale. So, yeah, that started to become significant money for a band. And then, as Damon knows and mentions in his essay, then there's all the publishing royalties, too. So if you're a songwriter, you get that crucial 9 cents per song or whatever the rate is now for every unit that you sell. And so the problem, I mean, I'm digressing here, but the problem for the record industry, bands are sort of a slightly different thing, but for the record labels is that over the last decade, we've seen this shift away from selling very lucrative $18 CDs to selling basically 99-cent songs on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And not even that, you know, streaming for free on Spotify. So yes, it's hard times for people who are in the record industry, but, you know, I think there are some positive things happening, and there are some ways that bands can make money, and I can get into that.
I want to get to that in a little while. One more question about the good old days, in quotation marks. Music fans often felt like they were being ripped off back then, and musicians also were complaining, Damon, correct? I mean, people weren't happy then either.
Well, because as Steve knows the figures very well from the label's point of view, but of course what actually flowed to the bands was a very different thing. And as Steve is correct, it depended completely on your, and still does, on your individual relationship to the label. But the labels have time-honored ways of accounting that do not allow all that money to flow to the band. So many, many bands who signed to major labels ended up never receiving royalties because their account was in debt. So even though the CDs were selling at tremendous profits for the record companies in that period that Steve writes about, they also had were spending money on promotion. It was the age of expensive music videos, and all this is recoupable, which is the phrase in the music industry for billing the band back before allowing them to have any artist royalties. The one other thing I wanted to point out is on the indie world, a very common structure, which is very easy for everyone to understand, was a 50-50 profit split between the band and the label. And this is still an active model. It really came out of punk rock and artist-run labels. But labels like Drag City, for example, in Chicago, very successful independent labels, still operate that way. And people probably know Joanna Newsom, who's on that label. So they've had records that sell in great quantity, but they've managed to continue that punk rock business ethic. It hasn't worked for everybody, but for some people that works. And that's a good rule of thumb to kind of think of how the indie label approached the share with the band. But again, profit, what is actually profit is the question, and I think that relates very strongly to the issues now, which is my article, which is about Spotify and Pandora. These are companies that are in the red. They are reporting losses. So if you're talking about the traditional model, profit share, they have nothing to share. On the other hand, they are capitalized in the billions. That's no exaggeration. And so they are making millions, they're making personal fortunes for everybody who has ownership in the companies, but they are running at a negative profit. So when they say they're sharing revenue, the revenue is really not the portion of the income that they're focused on in the first place. That's the point I was trying to express in my article.
And you say it's more speculation than an actual business. It's more Wall Street. You're betting on something.
Well, it's a business in the sense that it's a business that benefits the owners, and the stockholders are owners, but it does not, it's not tied to the product and to the producers of the product that is fueling the industry. So a record company, on the other hand, even the most, you could make up the parity and you'd probably be right, even how little, it doesn't matter how much you know the details of the music industry. If you imagine, you know, the parity of the money-grubbing, greedy record company president, he's probably, or and it was he always, probably did everything that you could imagine someone like that would do. And yet, they were also producing records. And so at the bottom of that pyramid was always the concern with how do artists actually make records.
There was a tie to the product still.
Absolutely. And now if you look at, for example, Spotify or Pandora or Apple, for that matter, iTunes, and Steve, when you were talking about 99 cents, I suddenly thought, why didn't they just call it the 99 cent store for music?
Right.
That would have been so good. You look at these companies, and of course, these are now the replacements for record stores, for the entire distribution chain, for the sale of music, and yet none of them have any tie to producing music. So they have no responsibility, ultimately, to ensuring that the flow of music continues. The record companies, no matter how large and how much they cheated artists, did have to make sure they continued to allow the artists to make music. And
right.
I think that's an enormous change.
We're coming up on a break. I'm going to give Steve Knopper a chance to respond in just a moment. We're talking with Damon Krukowski of Galaxy 500 and also Steve Knopper, who writes for Rolling Stone and has also written a book. We're talking about the music industry and how everything is working these days in the digital age where people are downloading music. Join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Tate Weller, Certified Public Accountant, celebrates 90 years of specialized audit, tax, and advisory services to national and global nonprofit and financial services clients. TAITWeller.com. Tate Weller. Focus. Expertise. Results.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA's Office of Admissions is hosting an open house on Saturday, December 15th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. with information about the 3 undergraduate and 2 graduate programs of study at the nation's first museum and fine arts school. PAFA's curriculum focuses on the following areas of fine arts study: painting, drawing, printmaking, and sculpture. Info at 215-972-7625. Or admissions at pafa.edu.
Wherever you live, whatever you're into, Newsworks.org has you covered. Whether it's insightful reporting on Philadelphia city life, New Jersey politics, or small wonders in Delaware, you're covered. Lovers of the arts, health and science, looking for something unique? You guessed it, covered. Repairing your carburetor? Okay, maybe not everything, but for solid journalism and thought-provoking discussion, choose WHYY's Newsworks.org. Smart, local, news. Covered.
Supporting WHYY, Kevin O'Brien Studio makes fabrics by hand in Philadelphia. This year's Kevin O'Brien Trunk Show is at 17 North 3rd Street, offering silk scarves, pillows, and bedding. More details at kevinobrienstudio.com.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscawain. We're talking about the music industry and how anybody is making any money now that we're all downloading stuff basically for free. We're chatting with Rolling Stone contributor Stephen Knopper and musician Damon Krukowski. And in a little while, we'll hear from Nick Krill of the Spinto Band, which is based in Wilmington. And now, Steve, I want you to describe some of the things Damon was talking about before our break. And maybe before we do all that, can you describe for us what exactly is Pandora, what is Spotify, how do these services work?
Sure, absolutely. And you know, I don't really have anything to disagree with in what Damon says. I think he's totally right, and his essay is right on point. Let's see. So Spotify is a streaming subscription service, which means that it's sort of like a modern, I guess the way I look at it is a modern, completely on-demand internet radio station, although it's not technically internet radio. It's on demand, so that means that for free, if you download the Spotify app on your desktop, the Spotify software, you can basically listen to just about any song ever made for free, as long as you listen to a few ads in between every few songs. You can also pay $10 a month for the premium Spotify service, and you can get it on your phone, and you can get the privilege of not having ads. So it becomes a very powerful service, and it's not the only one. I mean, there are many other services like it now, Mog and RDO, and of course the one that's been around forever, which is also still great, is Rhapsody. And as Damon mentions in his essay, these services are all really, really excellent for a consumer. You know, you can just turn on your computer or fire up your iPhone, and there's every song ever made. I frankly listened to it. To prepare for this interview, I listened to some Galaxy 500, so I guess that's another $0.004611 in Damon's pocket.
The check is in the mail, Damon.
Yeah, right. I'll just interject that I love Spotify. I'm actually a paid subscriber.
Yeah.
I pay them $9.99 a month because this, you know, I tried it for free when it first came in the U.S., and it is a music lover's dream.
Of course.
And I pay to keep the ads off and so that I can use it on my phone. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And Steve, what's in it for, other than the 0.001 cent, what's in it for the musicians? Obviously, they might get exposure, right?
Yeah. Well, let me get to that.
Okay.
First, I want to clarify something that Damon said. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with him because I think he's right on. But the one thing that I do want to clarify is that Spotify is not really in the position of having replaced a record label in the digital age. It's more in the position of having replaced or sort of, how should I say, evolved beyond the traditional record stores. So, So the iTunes, the Spotify's, those kind of companies make deals with the record labels, which are still the companies that represent the artists. And in most cases, in the case of Spotify or RDO or Mog or those kinds of companies, the streaming subscription companies, they pay the record labels up front, sometimes many tens of millions of dollars, in order for the right to use their catalogs, for the right to stream all that great music that Damon and I just said that we appreciate so much on that service. And so, you know, unfortunately, the record labels are not making the greatest deals for the artists, you know, and perhaps, I mean, and it's always been thus. I mean, the major artists, if you're Metallica or Lady Gaga or Adele or whatever, you're actually starting to make some okay money off of a Spotify. Like I interviewed a prominent music business attorney who represents major artists. When I first talked to him about Spotify a year ago, I said, "What are the royalty payments like?" And he said, "Lunch used to be breakfast," and then just recently I asked him if that had expanded to dinner, and he said, "Well, maybe a cheap dinner." So you know, for major artists, that it's all dependent on the number of streams. It's starting to get significant, and the Spotify argument, the way they would respond to things like Damon's essay, and I, you know, just take this with what you will. I'm just being devil's advocate. Is they would say, "Well, we're still kind of at the beginning of our service as we grow." we'll start to make more and more, we'll have many, many more streams and be able to pay out more and more money to artists.
And Steve, how do they come up with the math so that they send a check to Damon then for 21 cents? How does that all
right.
come about?
I mean, there's as Damon mentions in his essay, and you can read that because it gets right into the
weeds. Oh, I did.
I won't get into that here, but there's a couple of different revenue streams that the artist makes from Spotify. One is from the master recording. So that means if you're the performer of the song, and not whether or not you wrote the song, you have a deal with your record label, and the record label pays you by contract a certain percentage of how much you sell, or in the case of Spotify, how many streams you have. And so that's all kind of worked out through the label, and all those formulas is sort of like the label being the middleman, you know, making a deal with Spotify on one hand and making a deal with the artist in their contract on the other. And there's a lot of lawsuits about this. Like, right now, the question is...
Yeah, the Internet Radio Fairness Act.
Right. It's again, getting into the legal weeds, there's a question of whether a Spotify stream or an iTunes sale constitutes a traditional sale or whether it's more of a licensing fee like you would do when you license a song to a movie, which is much more lucrative. So that's all tied up in court right now, and it may change.
And I want to get to that a little bit later. But Damon, as you mentioned, these services, Pandora and Spotify, they're losing millions of dollars. So where's all of this going to go?
Right. Well, so they claim. But they're also, Steve, maybe you remember the figure Coca-Cola just invested into Spotify. Is it now a $3 billion valued company, I think it is?
I don't remember the exact.
Yeah, so it's the companies are valued tremendously. It's like Facebook, like any of these internet companies. What they say they're losing on is their revenue versus what they pay out, for example, in royalties. The question is, what is their revenue really? Their revenue is my $9.99 a month that I'm paying for that access. And that's not very much. So it's much, much less than would be taken in through traditional means for the amount of music that I am enjoying via Spotify. Just to go back to something Steve said, which I think is really crucial, is about the label's relationship to, I know about Spotify anyway, I don't know about Pandora, but Spotify, to come into the U.S. market, it started in Europe, they needed access to the music, and most of the music, just by sheer quantity, is held by major labels, and the major labels, there are only a few of them, so they needed their cooperation to enter the U.S. market without being considered a pirate website, like Napster was originally.
Yep.
And what they did, the way they convinced the labels, was not to offer them powerful royalty share. They gave them 18% ownership of the company.
Hmm.
So the major labels are stockholders in Spotify. In exchange, the labels accepted whatever royalty they accepted. They have not made that public information. The rest of us who aren't represented by major labels were presented with take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You can be part of this new revolution for how people listen, or you cannot be. And really, I don't know any musician who doesn't want their music heard. That's why we make music. We want to share our music.
So. And where else would you have it heard these days? I mean, most people listen to music on these services now.
Absolutely. Or anyway, they listen to it on their computers and on their phones. So, for example, we stream our own music for free already through a wonderful site called Bandcamp, which is I really highly recommend for bands just starting out. Exactly. It's really terrific because you can sell your music as well directly to buyers if they choose to buy, but you can also choose to stream for free. So the majors, in other words, took ownership of the company. So they are participating in it's not about the profit in a balance sheet, which is how these companies say they're losing money. It's about their capitalization. 18% of $3 billion is a lot of money. And that's what the labels are benefiting from. Now, what they did for their artists was obviously a completely separate negotiation, one in which they were not on the same side, shall we say, as the artists in trying to win them the most possible because they became ownership.
Yeah, so they are now in a split position of sorts. And that's Damon Krukowski from Galaxy 500, and also Damon and Naomi. And we're also chatting with Steve Knopper, who is a writer, for example, for Rolling Stone. And now we're going to be joined by Nick Krill, who is with the Spinto Band, which is based in Delaware. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Now, Nick, I found your band back in the day on MySpace, which seems about as outdated as CDs now. Is that where you started to publicize your band?
On the internet, certainly. I mean, I guess we started just like they were saying earlier, just trying to play local little clubs and stuff like that and sort of try and give your CDs to the college radio station and stuff. But then, yeah, once the internet became a really awesome sharing space, we kind of put our music out there and tried to get it out that way.
And when did you start the Spinto Band?
Probably back in high school, so it was like 1998 or something, you know.
All right, so right in the beginning of all of this. So
yeah.
So how many guys are in your band?
Right now there's five of us.
Okay, and have you had any success financially?
Yeah, we have. It's sort of been, I consider it like the last 6 or 7 years is sort of like building a career, and there's been peaks and valleys, you know, there's times of feast and times of famine, but I feel like even when I need to pick up sort of extra side work to supplement the band, it's usually in the music field, so I'm pretty lucky in that respect.
And is it harder because there are five of you and you have to split everything five ways?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's sort of just when you split up something, it goes into little bitty pieces. But I mean, we're all pretty nice guys and friendly about it, so it's not really,
so far, right?
Yeah, not really a big deal to split stuff.
And do you all have day jobs? Sorry, I don't mean to be mean, but do you all have other jobs to support yourself?
At the moment, we're picking up extra work here and there. Like I said, there's been like times, you know, a few years back where we were making a full-time living, and then times now where we need to pick up work. I guess the whole idea of like a full-time, I feel like being in a musician is always a full-time job, but whether or not I'm making a living at the moment varies from day to day.
All right, let's hear. Can I ask you a question?
Nick, when you are making money from Spinto Band, is it from live performance or from your recordings?
There's a couple different things. It's been, you know, live obviously is a big chunk of it, less or so recordings, and then also another big factor for us that has been really helpful is licensing.
Okay, mm-hmm. So, and you know, Nick, sorry to interrupt, but yeah, you just said licensing, so let's hear one of your songs which got licensed and was a hit, definitely, and also got licensed and actually made you some money. Here is Oh Mandy from 2006. All right, and that's Oh Mandy from the Spinto Band. And Nick, tell us what happened with that song.
I guess that was, like you said, sort of one of our first songs to kind of get some wide recognition. And then it ended up back in, like, I guess, the fall of 2005 was approached to be used in a Sears commercial.
And did you have a lawyer, or who approached you?
I think it came through our record label at the time, which is Bar None Records, a little independent label out of Hoboken.
Mm-hmm.
It came through them.
And then they took a chunk and you got a chunk.
Yeah, it's just sort of like they were talking before, everybody got a little split.
And what did your fans say when your song appeared in a Sears commercial? Fellow musicians?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I feel like back at that time, it was sort of, there's some mixed reactions, you know, like some people were like, oh, no, that's terrible, you're like damaging your art. But at the same time, I mean, in our eyes, we wanted to make music, and this was allowing us to do it. So it made sense, you know. Like we weren't really making any money at the time, and significantly in any other really records or live. So it was sort of an amazing thing to have happen.
And what do you enjoy about operating in this digital world? I mean, production has gotten much easier, distribution. What is good about all of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess for the music fan, it's amazing, like everybody's been saying, just the ability to have this resource and dig through music and be inspired by it. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, from our standpoint, like from a business standpoint, one kind of cool thing is I feel like it's allowed bands to kind of cut out a lot of the middlemen that have kind of been mentioned previously in the show. So, like, for example, there's like services like TuneCore or something that a band can use that to get their music out on a lot of digital service providers, and then that, you know, that takes out the record label part of it. So you're just going straight to somebody else to get on the digital ways. Or there's like we use a little service called Topspin, which is a pretty cool service that provides online kind of retail and marketing tools to artists and bands, and that allows us to really engage with fans, like really like directly to fans, I guess, instead of through any other kind of like middlemen and stuff like that.
And what's next for the Spinto Band?
Well, we just finished up a brand new record that's going to come out.
Are you going to actually press that, or what are you going to do with it?
Yeah, it'll be pressed physically in vinyl.
In real material.
Yeah, I have a real artifact, and then digital.
CD
digital
too,
artifact.
Or no CDs?
It'll be CD as well.
Wow. Real
yeah,
old
that,
school,
it was
Nick.
Funny. That was like a big debate in the band. Like, do we really want to make a CD? Like, what
do people? So people seriously still have record players, Nick? Your fans, your age, have record players?
Yeah. I they do, and it's a little beautiful little artifact to have. That's for sure.
All right. And so you're sorry. What's the name of this album?
That'll be called Cool Cocoon, and it's out February 5th.
And tour? Are you going on tour as well?
Yeah, we'll be on tour in the States in the Northeast in February, and over in Europe in February, and again in March.
And so, just before we go, Nick, the tour then pays for itself, and you also can make enough money to live while you're on tour. Is that the deal?
That's the ideal situation.
And what's reality?
Yeah, I mean, that it's funny. That's something we've been grappling with this week, is just trying to figure out like how we can make sure we break even and make sure everybody has a little something to take home at the end of the tour. But, you know, it's tough, but we're going to make it work.
And all of you then will go back and do more work. And, you know, how long can you do this for?
I'm not going to stop. I feel like if I don't stop being a musician, I just won't stop being a musician, you know? I'm just going to be doing it. I can't stop now. I'm just doing it forever.
All right, that's Nick Krill, and I have used your music many times on many of my productions, so I want to thank you for that. And he is with the Spinto Band, which is a Wilmington-based indie rock band. And we're going to take a short break in a moment, and then we're going to talk more with Rolling Stone contributor Steve Knopper and musician Damon Krukowski of Damon and Naomi and Galaxy 500. And we're also going to listen to some of their music. I feel like we haven't listened to enough music during this show, talking about music the whole time. And of course, we're going to get to your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. There will be a referendum on Egypt's new constitution this weekend. President Morsi says it needs to be moved on quickly, but opponents say not so fast. Also, college football bowl games, 35 this season. One commentator says they're a scam to benefit the people who run them. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Winter Tour presents A Feast for the Eyes, a holiday tour of Henry Francis DuPont's ancestral home, now through January 6th. Tours will showcase Winter Tour's traditional holiday displays, featuring interiors bedecked in holiday finery and decorated trees, including the dried flower tree, a Yuletide tradition, plus special exhibitions, shopping, and dining. Yuletide at Winter Tour reservations and details at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Winter Tour proudly supports WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowane. We're talking about the music industry and how musicians and other people are making any money now that everybody is downloading things and sharing files. We're with Damon Krukowski of the indie rock duo Damon and Naomi, and also he was in Galaxy 500. And we also are joined by Steve Knopper, a music writer who contributes to Rolling Stone and many other publications, has also written a book on this whole topic. Let's go to the phone. We have Chris joining us from Bucks County. Hi, Chris. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to comment that I recently attended a show up at the Sellersville Theater, and it was one of sort of the Grateful Dead spinoff bands.
Mm-hmm.
A guy named Steve Kimmock. They call him the Guitar Monk. He's from Bethlehem, actually. He's local. They made available a recording of that night's performance if you wanted to pay a little extra money. And it could be sent to your computer, or I think if you waited, they could burn a CD for you. And I thought that was an interesting way that you could still, you know, have a keepsake of the performance. You know, it wouldn't be, you know, studio quality, but it would be from the soundboard.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could save it.
That's great, and that's one example in which musicians are finding new ways to make money, and somebody in my control room says KISS has been doing this for years. Damon Krukowski, mm-hmm. What's your take? Are you finding new ways to supplement your income, so to speak?
Yeah, well, the Pixies, I know, started doing it,
right,
when they reunited
the
as well. And that's interesting phenomenon of tying the sales of the music in a recorded fashion to the live show, which speaks to, I think, a young band like Spinto Band's experience and a lot of bands right now of every age, that the live performance has become a major part of their ability to make a living if they can. And that's why you see reunions on the road, bands that retired coming out of retirement, bands that don't speak to each other back on stage together, because the component of their income that was made up of record sales has been disappearing. It was interesting to hear from Nick how his perspective as a band his age of where their income comes from, and really records are very little of it. Licensing, which is, again, not about a sale to fans unit by unit. It's just a deal between companies, similar to the deals that are made between the label, major labels, and Spotify, for example, a lump sum payment of some kind, and not this traditional manner of upselling the recorded music and live performance, which has become so important, as the caller Chris is pointing out.
And are people going to shows in the same numbers they used to, more so, less so?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not an expert in that by any means.
Maybe we'll see what Steve. Do you have any take on that?
I do, and the answer is basically yes. And in fact, I mean, the phenomenon that Damon's talking about is happening in an incredibly widespread way. I mean, over the last decade, as profits and revenues from recorded music sales have gone down and down, more and more of these acts have gone on the road. And so, what's happening is that ticket prices, the demand is very high, and ticket prices are going up and up for the top acts. And clubs are finding their rosters more and more crowded. And so it becomes now everybody wants to be on the road, and it's becoming a little bit more competitive. And, you know, there's only a finite number of gigs that you can play, and there's only a finite number of people who will go to them. And that was that sort of started to become a problem during the economic crisis. It kind of peaked around 2010 when you started to see, you know, major acts like Christina Aguilera or somebody go out on the road and have to cancel her show because she raised the tickets just a bit too high. So you know, there definitely is some risk in the concert business for sure. I just wanted to say one quick thing about the concert business, which we've touched on but haven't really delved into, is that live is, as Damon said, is kind of the center at this point of an artist's universe as far as economics. You know, the idea for a lot of acts is to build buzz on a service like Spotify or even iTunes or something else, and then use that as sort of a loss leader to get fans to come and pay a lot of money for your tickets or for your T-shirts or whatever else. And that's kind of always been true. I mean, when bands were in debt to their record labels, you know, back in the day, as Damon talked about, the money stream that they kept as their very own was always the concert stream. So they could still keep their percentage of the tickets, and they could still keep their percentage of the T-shirts and the caps that they sell. And that was a way that even if they were in incredible debt to the record labels, many of them or some of them could still survive. So to that extent, things really haven't changed a great deal in the industry. It's just that, like Damon says in his essay, the masters are different. The man is different. It's Spotify now and the people who run that company.
And Damon,
rather than Tower or whatever.
Damon, did you have any comment on that?
Oh, yeah. I just want to say I think that the economic pressure has been tremendous for people going to concerts. And what I know at a lower level of the industry is that there's competition, as Steve is saying, but also that there's competition for the ticket sale because people don't go out as often as they did. And so they save up and choose a show. And so the experience that I've been seeing firsthand is that at the club level, the clubs that bands like we and the Spinto Band have always played, people don't go regularly out to hang out the way they did when tickets were cheaper and times were more flush. They choose one show, and they tend to choose the same show. And so the buzz bands that generate a lot of attention online are suddenly playing to much bigger venues than they would have been.
Yeah.
But everybody else is really fighting for just to fill even small rooms. And so you did hear how Nick said they're trying to figure out their live finances, how to break even. So they're not going on the road necessarily to make a profit still at this point. They probably are hoping to break into that level where they become a band that everyone online is talking about. And at that point, the profits are very large live. The other thing I want to mention that Steve was saying, back in the good and bad old days, actually a lot of bands, especially at our level, went into debt on the road, and tour support was something that and still is in some cases money that labels would give the band to underwrite the tour to bring it back to a break-even level, and that tour support is one of the mechanisms by which labels avoid paying royalties from CD and record sales to the bands, because tour support is 100% recoupable. It comes before the profits that are made for your royalties. So often the old cycle, when in the 90s especially, when a lot of indie bands suddenly became major label bands, the labels would design very big shows for them, put them in tour buses, very expensive to rent, hire roadies, buy all new equipment. I remember playing a show in San Diego at a club we'd played a million times, the Casbah, and in rolls a band, it was a Weezer offshoot that hadn't ever played a show before, and they pull up in their tour bus and unload all these road cases that still had price tags on them from Guitar Center. And it was that kind of feeling of, well, you know, this is going to be big, so we'll underwrite the tour, make it look big, and everything will follow suit. But of course,
and the band will never make a dime, ultimately.
Right, exactly, because every one of those tour cases and the bus and everything else had been underwritten by tour support by the label. So it was another pressure on bands, or another another block to actually seeing their share of those enormously profitable CD sales.
And I want to get one more phone call in. We have Tony from Buckingham who is joining us. Hi, Tony. You're on Radio Times.
Yes.
Hello. Go ahead.
Well, so we're a small music publisher, and my wife and partner, Kathy Block, has a song that's been covered twice by boy bands. So the perspective of a writer is a little different than a band.
Mm-hmm.
We don't share in performance at all, but we get royalties. And so last Christmas season, a band released a cover of her song, Christmas with My Girl, and, you know, you're talking about streams. So on YouTube, during the Christmas season, it accumulated about 1.5 million views.
Incredible.
And we thought, wow, we hit pay dirt. But so in June or July, I forget when it was, when the royalty for those streams came in, the check was about $44 and some pennies.
Mm. Nice.
For 1.5 million. And at this point, this season, that song has reached about 4 million views, so I guess we have another $40 coming.
Good.
Next summer.
Where are you going for dinner? So,
well, we're a family of five.
Oh.
So
But, Steve, you write about YouTube and how people can or obviously cannot make any money on that. So can you break that down for us?
Yeah, I mean, YouTube is, like Spotify, it's the formula is a little bit murky, you know. Nobody actually comes out and says, yes, we're YouTube, and this is how much we pay artists per stream. You know, the estimates that I've gotten from the industry is that you get something like, and I'm not sure how much this squares with the caller's experience, but it's something like $1 for every 1,000 streams or something like that. And so it's very, very minuscule, just as it is with Spotify.
Thank you so much, Tony, for your call. And Steve, I've been meaning to ask you, we've been talking about rock music this entire time. How are other musicians affected, classical musicians? Are they impacted in similar ways, or is their world just very different?
Yeah, I mean, I don't cover classical music as much. But, you know, certainly classical music's a little different because, you know, you have orchestras performing all this stuff, and then the members of the orchestras get paid, you know, a wage. So that also goes to live performance too. As far as, you know, how well classical recordings sell, I don't think that's a huge part of the pie, or jazz, or, you know, certain other genres. You know, what my focus is at Rolling Stone is usually pop or rock or hip hop or that sort of thing.
And Damon, another quick question. Mm-hmm. What's the role of ASCAP these days?
Well, ASCAP and BMI are companies that collect for performance royalties, which means when your record is played on the radio,
mm-hmm.
for example. And they are involved in the collection from these streaming services. So that is the that's the intermediary that a lot of bands use for collection of for example, from Pandora. I think it's really amazing to hear that story of a songwriter who's able to make something so popular and yet not make money from it,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, as an independent band, we always knew we'd never write, I forget the title of that Christmas song he just said, but we knew we never had that, we didn't have that knack. We couldn't write a hook that would get 1.5 million, anything. But, of course, we always thought if you did, that would be, of course, that's the house in the Hollywood Hills and the gravy train that everybody was looking for. And it's amazing to hear that even someone with that kind of talent can't translate it into an income now.
So can ASCAP keep track of all of these different streaming services? How does anybody keep track of who's playing your song?
Oh, I think just like always, everything is reported that needs to be reported, and that's all flowing smoothly. I have no doubt that the actual reports are as truthful as they ever were. It's really just a question of what kind of monetization is attached to these acts, and that is what has obviously changed tremendously. I think it's really interesting to remember that Steve's book, Appetite for Self-Destruction, is a really great explanation of this era of the CD. Those of us who are our age, Mike, and I'm talking to you because I know you're my age, we share that history, know a music industry that was shaped not only by the traditional LP market, but by this particular short-lived, as it turns out, boom fueled by the CD. And the CD was an enormously profitable object. It cost nothing to manufacture, and the labels got away with charging an enormous amount for it. So a lot of practice that we come out of in the recent past is based on boom times. And I think it's kind of a useful thing to keep in mind. So all these sorts of habits that developed and even the way that bands toured, what types of venues they were playing, a lot of that was underwritten by that spectacularly profitable medium, which is really defunct now.
Yeah,
that's why I asked Nick if he was making them. Vinyl is back. Our fans are buying vinyl. Young bands are selling vinyl. Older bands are reselling vinyl. But the total numbers are very low. And, of course, vinyl is just not as profitable.
Yeah. And quick, we are coming up on the end of the show. So let me turn to you, Steve, first. What do you think is next? We only have about a minute left. What's next? What will work? And will we still have musicians? Because if nobody makes any money,
right,
why would they stick it out?
I mean, I guess the only thing I would say is that artists have to be pretty savvy. And I'm sympathetic to what Damon is saying and what the callers have been saying. But artists have to be pretty savvy to use these services and not just say, these services should be in and of themselves the thing that allows me to make my living. You know, if I get a big song on YouTube, I have to figure out from that how to generate money off of that buzz. So if I have a YouTube video that goes viral, it's a novelty hit or whatever it is, and it gets 5 million views, then I have to figure out how to monetize it. How do I shift people from watching my video on YouTube to buying a song on iTunes or buying my T-shirt or coming to my concert? And as Damon said, you know, that's not easy. It's never been easy. But that's sort of the challenge of musicians today. And you know, the good and the bad is the bad is they don't have a record label anymore, or they often don't anymore because they've shrunk so much. But the good is that they don't get screwed by a record label.
All right. Yeah. That is Steve Knopper. He is a writer and has written for Rolling Stone. We've also been joined by Damon Krukowski, who is with Galaxy 500, and Damon and Naomi. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Dennis Devine, Patty McMahon, and Susan Greenbaum. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. And let's close with that 21-cent song, Tugboat, by Galaxy 500. Thank you so much for being with us. And coming up next on WHYY, a special production by our health